In the first round of the playoffs in four lopsided losses to the Cleveland Cavaliers. The organization said after that series that Curry would return. Detroit began the season with big hopes but couldn't recover from the loss of all-star point guard Chauncey Billups in a November trade to Denver for Allen Iverson. Coach Flip Saunders was fired last year after he led the team to the Eastern Conference Finals in each of his three seasons. In baseball, ace Chris Carpenter takes the mound tonight for the Cardinals in St. Louis against Randy Johnson and the San Francisco Giants. Left-hander Ted Lilly goes for his eighth win of the season tonight in Pittsburgh as the Cubs take on the Pirates in Game 2 of their three-game set. And the Chicago White Sox have won 10 of 14 games and will take on Cleveland tonight at Progressive Field. That's sports.
Programming on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at tnol.com.
Oakland, California is short on cash, and it's thinking it might find a pot of gold in pot. The city is about to decide whether to impose a huge new increase on the tax it imposes on shops that sell medical marijuana. What's surprising is that the people who sell medical marijuana say higher taxes may actually help their business. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
In a downtown Oakland coffee shop, Rock Music welcomes a steady flow of customers seeking a quick jolt of Java. But anyone with a doctor's note can buy something more relaxing. How about an eighth ounce of high-grade medical marijuana? That's $40 for the cannabis and $4 in sales tax. For Richard Lee, the owner of this pot club, the sales tax is just the price of doing business.
My business pays $300,000 a year in sales tax, plus another $500,000 in payroll taxes, income taxes. So we estimate all four dispensaries in Oakland pay over $1 million a year in sales tax already.
And now the city of Oakland wants a bigger cut of Lee's action. Right now, medical marijuana dispensaries pay a city tax of $1.20 for every $1,000 they take in. In July, voters will decide whether the dispensaries should pay even more, as much as $18 for every $1,000 in gross receipts. Lee and other dispensary owners not only support the proposed new taxes, they're the ones who brought the idea to city officials in the first place.
We're basically just trying to say we're like other businesses, you know, we're here to pay taxes, create jobs, and improve the community.
Councilwoman Rebecca Kaplan says the new tax could generate upwards of $1 million annually and would make Oakland the first city in the country to directly tax medical marijuana.
You know, obviously, in these economic times, we're trying to find revenue everywhere we can. And so to have someone stepping up and saying, you know, we're willing to pay more, it's a pretty beautiful thing.
It's not the first time officials have looked to marijuana to fill their tax coffers. A bill to legalize and tax cannabis statewide has already been introduced in the California legislature. And state finance officials estimate that legalized pot could bring in about $1.5 billion in new taxes to the cash-strapped state. But opponents of medical marijuana aren't convinced. Calvina Fay is the executive director of the Drug-Free America Foundation. She says medical marijuana may be legal in California and 12 other states, but its sale is still a federal crime.
I think it is one more step in creating the illusion that they're operating within the law, that what they're doing is okay.
Other critics of the tax proposal say the medical marijuana industry is looking for more than legitimacy. Ron Brooks, the president of the National Narcotics Officers Association's Coalition, says the ultimate goal is the legalization of cannabis.
Their strategy has long been that they just can't go to the voters right now in today's environment and say legalize marijuana. But they know that there is a growing movement that supports marijuana. And unfortunately, when you start to chip away at our national drug policy, you know, you begin to have people believe that somehow this is safe.
Brooks won't get much argument from dispensary owner Richard Lee. He says the Oakland tax proposal is written so broadly that it would cover anyone involved with growing and selling marijuana should it ever become legal.
We see it as part of the overall picture of legalization, of changing the attitudes toward cannabis, you know, that instead of seeing it as an underground thing that people do to get out of paying taxes, you know, we're trying to make it a regular part of the business of the city.
A recent field poll shows for the first time 56% of those surveyed in California support legalization of marijuana, and Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says he's ready for an open debate on the idea. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, Oakland.
Most of the world's forests are on dry land, but in a few special places on Earth, forests grow underwater. They're kelp forests, and they're home to an astounding array of marine life. Trouble is, these underwater forests are vanishing. Ann Dornfeld reports on efforts to turn the tide.
A healthy kelp forest is so thick with fish and invertebrates that you'd swear you were looking at an aquarium exhibit. They're biodiversity hotspots, places that feed and protect an extraordinary number of species. Brian Mukes of Santa Monica Baykeeper is standing on the deck of a boat in his wetsuit. He's looking proudly at a thriving kelp forest along a rocky coastline near Los Angeles.
This is our little jewel on this coast. Not only does the kelp forest have over 800 species that are dependent on it, but over a quarter of all California marine species are dependent upon the kelp forest during some part of their life cycle.
Since the 1960s, Southern California has lost 90% of its kelp forests. The culprit looks like a small purple pincushion. It's a sea urchin. Urchins love to eat kelp, and their populations have gone out of control. That's because overfishing has removed most of the large fish and lobsters that eat urchins. A few years ago, urchins had mowed this kelp forest down to just a few square feet. So Mukes and a team of baykeeper volunteers are trying to restore the balance. They're licensed by the state to do urchin relocation.
What we do is go down, collect urchins by hand, get them on the boat, and relocate them to areas where they will no longer harm a kelp forest.
Sounds easy enough.
Some of them you're going to want to just pull off the reef. They look like they can come off, but I just recommend using the tool. Urchin spines in your fingers is not fun.
Or maybe not. Either way, it's time for us to gear up and jump in. 25 feet underwater, the ocean surges so violently that the divers cling to rocks so they won't be swept away. It's tricky to find a safe rock to grab because most of them are covenant urchins that have moved in on this young kelp forest. But urchins aren't the only migrants. Huge purple sheephead and fire orange Garibaldi fish swim by. A small octopus sits curled in a crevice. Pastel sea stars are everywhere. 4 years ago, this site was pretty much just rocks and urchins. Two dives later, the divers are back on the boat.
How was the workout? How was the workout? I'm tired.
After the team hauls up bag after bag of purple and red urchins, we try unsuccessfully to extract a spine from one volunteer's finger. Next, we move to deeper water a mile away. This will be the urchin's new home. The divers count the prickly balls as they throw them overboard.
Purple.
Each time a diver counts 10 urchins of a particular color, he calls it out.
Purple. Purple.
Similar kelp restoration efforts have revived kelp forests along other stretches of the California coast. But while those projects involved reseeding of the kelp forest, Mukes says Baykeeper focuses on urchin relocation.
We found that mostly just get rid of the urchins and natural kelp spores will seed the reef and the return of kelp will ensue.
In all today, the team has relocated about 1,500 urchins. Between weekly trips like these and giant kelp's ability to grow as fast as 2 feet a day, kelp restoration is a heartening environmental success story. In order for Southern California's kelp forests to make a widespread comeback, Brian Mukes says the state will need to limit the fishing that caused this problem in the first place. And that issue is as prickly as an urchin. For the Environment Report, I'm Ann Dornfeld.
It's 2:49. For those of you who may have tuned in this afternoon hoping to hear about Twitter from Sarah Milstein, we've had to reschedule that interview. We'll talk with her, I think, next week. She was the 21st user to sign on to Twitter. We'll talk with her next week about just what Twitter is and what it's good for. There's a kind of blue and green scum that can bloom in lakes and ponds across the nation. This scum is called cyanobacteria. For years, scientists have known that this stuff can produce dangerous toxins. Amy Quinton reports, now researchers are studying whether there's a link between cyanobacteria and Lou Gehrig's disease.
Jody Connor reaches into his refrigerator in his lab.
This is the cyanobacteria that we've collected. This one comes from Harvey Lake in Northwood. And see how green that sample is?
He's the director of New Hampshire's Limnology Center. Connor has been collecting samples of cyanobacteria from lakes across New Hampshire. It looks like green, scummy algae on the surface of the water that can be several inches thick, but it's actually bacteria Connor says cyanobacteria feed on nutrients like phosphorus and nitrogen that can come from runoff of lawn fertilizers or sewage.
They need sunlight, they need phosphorus, and they seem to like the warmer waters. So they really grow in mass numbers when they have all three of those.
Jim Haney is a professor of biological sciences at the University of New Hampshire. He says in high enough concentrations, some cyanobacteria blooms can produce more than 70 different kinds of liver toxins called microcystins.
That scum can be toxic enough that it's been estimated that only about 17 milliliters is enough to kill the small child. Well, 17 milliliters translates in just a couple of teaspoons.
Cyanobacteria blooms can also produce neurotoxins. Haney and other researchers have embarked on research to find out if there's a connection between cyanobacteria and patients with Lou Gehrig's disease, also known as ALS. The research began when Dr. Elijah Stomel began mapping hundreds of ALS patients across New Hampshire. Stomel is a neurologist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. He noticed the incidence of ALS was 2.5 times greater than the national rate around lakes known to have had significant cyanobacteria blooms. Stonewall says he found a particularly high cluster of patients on one lake in the western part of the state.
We were able to establish that there appeared to be about a 25-fold increase in what one would expect to see for the ALS incidence.
But he's not sure if cyanobacteria are the culprit. A few scientific studies have shown a particular type of neurotoxin found in cyanobacteria is also found in patients with ALS. The neurotoxin is known as BMAA, but it's not known whether BMAA can trigger ALS. Jim Haney says more research is needed.
We know that in the laboratory, a wide range of different types of cyanobacteria are able to produce BMAA. So one of our goals this summer is to determine whether there are BMAA molecules present in our lakes.
So far, researchers haven't found BMAA, and there are still a lot of unknowns about how people could be exposed. Do you have to drink it, or can you breathe it in the air? How long do you need to be exposed to it before it can cause damage? Again, Dr. Elijah Stomel.
If there is a link between cyanobacterial blooms and the toxins they make and a neurodegenerative disease like ALS, then I think we should pursue that with as much vigor as we can. And I think that the neurology literature would suggest that there probably is an environmental trigger for ALS.
But scientists have not yet found that link. If they do, Stomel says that link might help find ways to prevent the dangerous toxins or block their effects. For the Environment Report, I'm Amy Quinton.
Don't stop believing that the music industry will do what it can to stop illegal downloads and uploads of music. In this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News, commentator Amy Gatta tells us about a $2 million verdict that all started with a popular song from Journey.
I'm just a city girl, born and raised in South Detroit. So when my family saw that the rock band Journey's song Don't Stop Believing was available for download for the music system we own, we quickly paid what turned out to be $2 for it. The song mentions a boy who shares my background, after all. Turns out that we got a real bargain. By playing by the rules, we saved ourselves what could have been thousands of dollars. The rules I'm referring to are copyright protection laws. Music is copyrighted material, and the government protects it in an effort to encourage artistic and other expression. Those who download music they haven't paid for, or those who upload music to share with others without permission, are violating the nation's copyright laws. And while you might think that those downloaders and uploaders who do so illegally will at most have to reimburse the music industry for the cost of the songs, usually around $1 each, Congress has decided that such a slap on the wrist would do little to stop the illegal music activity. Instead of 99 cents, some violators face statutory fines of up to thousands of dollars per song. Now, you might think that it would be a waste of time to sue an individual, a mom or pop or kid who violates the copyright laws. But a mother from Minnesota knows better. She made headlines a week or so ago when a court fined her more than $2 million for illegal downloading, uploading activity, including songs like Journey's Don't Stop Believing. And it's not just the uploaders who get into trouble. A few years ago, an Illinois music lover faced fines of $22,000 for illegally downloading songs for her personal use. She'd argued unsuccessfully that she was merely sampling songs to decide which music she would ultimately buy. What this tells us is that strangers are waiting up and down the information superhighway boulevard. Their shadows are searching in the night for those who download and upload illegally. Legal arguments in the Minnesota case revealed that these strangers work for the music industry. They download what they suspect is illegal music. After the download, they can tell from electronic information contained within the music file what computer had uploaded the file to the web. That's what happened in the Minnesota case, at least. A group called Media Sentry was able to tell from the Internet Protocol address that the uploads came from the Minnesota woman's computer. Her lawyers say that they'll appeal. The size of the verdict is certainly one possible ground. And even though the recording industry says that it's not going after individuals anymore, there's no guarantee that it won't change its mind. So there's something to be learned from the plight of the woman from Minnesota who illegally downloaded and or uploaded Don't Stop Believing and two dozen other songs. Some will win, some will lose, all because some were born to sing the blues and want to be paid for that singing. I'm Amy Guida.
Amy Guida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois.
Earth and sky.
Wind power is the only large-scale source of carbon-free electricity being brought into the world's electricity grids today.
You're listening to Christopher Flavin, president of the World Watch Institute, an environmental research organization that studies global trends in sustainability. Flavin said that wind power today across the world is surging.
It's beginning to displace a significant amount of coal-fired generating capacity. In the United States, over 40% of the new generating capacity added last year was wind. That's only surpassed by natural gas, and that only slightly.
Flavin said use of wind power is rising because more countries have laws that allow its suppliers better access to the electric grid. And he added the technology itself has gotten better. Wind turbines are bigger and more efficient.
And as a result, wind power is very close to economically competitive with most other new sources of electricity, particularly coal and gas.
Still, wind power only supplies about 1% of electricity in the U.S. Flavin said that in as little as 6 years, that number could rise to 6%.
Now that we're not only beginning to run into scarcity with some fuels like oil, but are also running into the limits in terms of the atmosphere's absorbing all the carbon dioxide, wind starts to look much more attractive than it was.
Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
WILL programs are made possible in part by Bevere Cafe, offering breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. and lunches from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday, and catering. Bevere Cafe is student-operated on the second